All right, get your Bible. You all can find your throne seat. Now, we led the lost tribes from one location with enough evidence that anyone who has listened can find it easy to believe that the tribes were never lost from God, those that were carried into Assyrian bondage, north of the Black Sea and north and west of it. They reappear as Scythians, which means nomads, Sumerians, which is a derivation of what the Assyrians called the house of Umri, the sixth king of the ten tribe nation to the north. And they appear as the Celts or Celts. We don't know where that name comes from yet. The Greek historians said that's what they called themselves, but that's the Greeks' attempt to pronounce what they called themselves. The purest, undiluted settlement of the Celts in the world, undiluted by Roman conquerors, landed and stayed and maintained in Ireland. There is little doubt that if the ten tribes lost into Assyrian bondage, lost to the sight of men until the work of the 1800s, are those tribes in nuclei source, then every promise about multiplied kings and multiplied nations has been fulfilled. The promises that concern us most are the promises to Judah that the scepter would never depart from Judah, a lawgiver from out of their midst, until Christ comes in his fullness, Shiloh comes. And second, that there was a promise given not only to Judah, and turn me down to get the ring out of this just a hair, not only was there a promise given to Judah that the scepter would not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from beneath her feet, or his feet. But in addition, there was the promise given that the seed of David, a particular descendant of Judah, would have one of his seed sitting on a throne over Israel, and God sets the pattern in the division of the kingdom and leaving a part with Solomon's son, that it doesn't have to be all, but there will be of the seed of David ruling over God's people, Israel, perpetually. So to find the ten lost tribes as the Celts and fulfill the promise of multiplied kingdoms, nations, and kings is not sufficient. We have to find over some of those lost tribes, or over the Jews, the descendants of Judah, someone holding the scepter of the Judaic line, and or there must be ruling over Israel in whole or part of the seed of David. So we left the Celts pretty much identified in source. We left the Irish with some dangling hints, and we went back, having opened the door, to find the possible link-ups with those Irish people of a seed of Judah and the seed of David. Now, the seed of Judah includes not only the line of Pharaohs, through whom Jesus was born, but in the genealogies of Matthew, we're reminded that Zara, who came out of the womb first in that strange happening in the book of Genesis and had a scarlet cord tied around its hand, and then the hand was withdrawn into the womb and Pharaoh was born. Zara was to serve a purpose in God's plan. So the sons of Zara, or Zala, and again we deal with a language that has no vowels. So don't get too concerned whether it's Zira, Zora, Zula, or Zara. But this son of Zara, as most frequently referred to, occasionally Zira, or sons, equally would fulfill the promise to Judah. If we can trace the lineage of Zara, find his sons ruling over any portion of God's people at any time, Judah's scepter still reigns. They haven't done much with the lawgiver. In tracing that lineage, the question was raised, how come Matthew set out to prove that Jesus was of the lineage of David, but in our King James Matthew version, it appears that he traces the lineage of Joseph, not a biological gene of which was in the flesh and blood temple named Jesus of Nazareth. So the lineage of Joseph doesn't prove hopscotch. If it is the lineage of Joseph, the husband of Mary, and only that. So we had a question suddenly leap up there, and we didn't have time to deal with it. In trying to find these scattered sons of Zara and Judah, were led back to Egypt and to the time before Egypt. And that family who went down to Egypt and who they were and what they were, not mangy, poor, begging shepherds, but kings, princes of a king, Jacob. It is easy to trace the arrival of the Miletians, and it's easy to trace the arrival of Brutus in England from Mediterranean nations to link them with God's people in Palestine or Egypt has been what we've been moving around for a while. A third thing equally important to tracing the lineage of the seed of David and the seed of Judah was the promise to Jeremiah that he would be the trustee of all those promises, to participate in the tearing down and the uprooting, but also the planting and the building of these displaced kingdoms. And we have the promise that he'll have his life for a prey and it'll be well for him and his remnant. And he'll go to a place he didn't know, an unknown place, and his enemies would treat him well. And we lose him in Egypt in the Bible, as we lost the 10 tribes at first glance in Assyria in the Bible. But other history finds them, as other history can find Jeremiah and the daughters of Zedekiah. Now, ultimately, we're getting back to the book of Genesis. These two books, Genesis and Revelation, tie together. I'm preaching Sundays on the book of Revelation. You can't understand the book of Revelation without understanding the prophetic voices of the Old Testament. And there is no possibility of understanding the prophetic voices of the Old Testament until you clearly understand the distinction between the house of Israel and the house of Judah. And the book of Genesis means exactly what its name implies, beginnings. And every major principle and act of God has its beginning in Genesis. So as we must look back to understand Revelation, we must move forward to give the meaning and color to the roots in Genesis, as we teach to it. So I've just been sailing back and forth between these two, which is the luxury of a preacher, from Genesis to Revelation. And to you that just joined us, that's what we've been teaching on festival. The Bible is still our compass. Outside the Bible, the gestalt of many happenings in history that can only be sorted out by a biblical understanding is impressing itself upon us as I throw it at you every night. The reason that many of the disciplines cannot gestalt these other scientific areas and bring them into a unified meaning, they don't believe the Bible, to their own hurt. Now, Egypt and the pyramid, I left them long ago and only hinted at them. But Egypt is very important to God's Word. To say the right things, I keep on reading them. And this one says the right things in a lot of places. Not a bad little book. It wasn't given to me. I knew about it and got it. Now, I want to read you something. Well, by the way, you know that archaeology uncovered the Book of the Dead. And the Book of the Dead is a holy book of ancient Egypt. Its primary contribution is it is written as the Gilgamesh epic of the flood was written from the heathen side without God's protective hand on it. And as the Irish legends were written from a heathen side, heathen by being separated into a status of not being God's people and sinking into that. But the cornerstone facts still hang in there. The Egyptian Book of the Dead is no Bible. It's the heathen side. It wasn't uncovered again until modern archaeology dug it up, enabling things in the Bible to be timelined and correlated. They refer to the pyramid as having spiritual and mystical and prophetic meaning. So long established in the historic foundations of Egyptian thought, the pyramid wasn't a tomb. It was a container of mysterious truth, spiritual in meaning, and prophetic in design. That doesn't make it true, which is kind of interesting. That's the way the most ancient of Egyptians looked at it. And in that Book of the Dead, they refer to the pyramid as the Pillar of Enoch. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? Well, you know, isn't that interesting? If they quote these verses, I know they're pretty safe. Isaiah 29, verses 19 to 20. And in that day, what day? We got that on our promise list? Let's see. Now, if you haven't been following with us, you won't have these numbers marked. I don't know if I've given you this one as a number yet or not. Let's just check and see. No? Oh, well, then I got to save that right there. I got to save that, don't I? And we got to go back and add some more numbers and come to that. I got to get that on your numbered list. Now, where were we last when we were writing down the numbers? Where? Somebody said 21. 37. Well, somebody over there saying 38. Somebody over there said 41. That's right. Who said that? Hold your hand up. Can't see your face. 41. Well, what is 41? That'll smoke him out, won't it? Huh? Numbers 24:17. We'll see. You know he's right. Well, let's go back to 38, since some people think 37 was the last one. So let's go back to 38. What's 37? Anybody know what 37 is? Not they shall be sifted through the nations as corn, speaking of the lost tribes, and not one grain will be lost. That was 37. Amos 9:9. 38. You remember our little dissertation on Balaam and his ass? Numbers 23. That must have made a profound effect on some of my people. Others, it just went right by them. Balaam is prophesying. Verses 9 and 10. Numbers 23. For from the top of the rocks I see him, and from the hills I behold him. Lo, the people shall dwell alone, and shall not be reckoned among the nations. Who can count the dust of Jacob and the number of the fourth part of Israel? Let me die the death of the righteous, and let my last end be like his. Now, that's a profound prophecy. Lo, the people shall dwell alone and shall not be reckoned among the nations. Now that's a segment of their history, singled out from all the other promises of greatness. Put 38 on that. I'll get back to it. 39, 24th chapter, Balaam still prophesying. And if there's anything has the weight of God's authority on it, it's this prophecy, because it's here that God says, God's not a man that he should lie, neither the son of man that he should repent. When he says it, he'll do it. 39th verse, Numbers 23, or rather 24, verse 7. His seed shall be in many waters. Now, I'm not going to take the time tonight to read the context. I'll come back to this to another time. I just want you to write them down. 7th verse, 24th chapter, his seed shall be in many waters. That's just a few words in the middle of the verse. Balaam lifted up his eyes and saw Israel abiding in his tents, according to their tribes. How goodly are thy tents, O Jacob, and thy tabernacles, O Israel. Verse 7, his seed shall be in many waters. 7th chapter. Now pray tell me where in either Assyria, Babylon, or Palestine you could say of them, his seed shall be in many waters. You can't. 9th verse, Let's just read the context on this one, though a set of wooden. God brought him forth out of Egypt. He hath, as it were, the strength of a unicorn. He shall eat up the nations, his enemies, and shall break their bones and pierce them through with his arrows. He couched. He lay down as a lion and as a great lion. Who shall stir him up? Blessed is he that blesseth thee, and cursed is he that curseth thee. That's the verse I want number 40 on. Blessed is he that blesseth thee, cursed is he that curseth thee. We've had people monopolize that verse to their own myopic, isolated purpose. But the promise is to all the seed of Jacob, not just Judah. Now, I think that's going to be news to some of you. Blessed is he that blesseth thee, and cursed is he that curseth thee. Verse 9, Numbers 24. 41. That's number 40. Got that? Number 41. Numbers 24:17. I shall see him, but not now. I shall behold him, but not nigh. There shall come a star out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel, and shall smite the corners of Moab, and destroy all the children of Sheth. That's number 41. I won't comment on it. Just leave it there. That's number 41. Now, let's go to Isaiah 19. Isaiah 19. And I got the number sequence. This will be number 42. Number 42. In that day, what day? We're talking about the great day yet to come. In that day, there shall be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar at the border thereof to the Lord. And it shall be for a sign and for a witness unto the Lord of hosts in the land of Egypt. For they shall cry unto the Lord because of the oppressors, and he shall send them a Savior and a great one, and he shall deliver them. Verse 19 and 20, Isaiah 19 and 20. That's number 42. What is this altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt that is yet to be noticed in that great day, and a pillar at the border thereof to the Lord? Now, Jeremiah 32, verse 18. Let's go there and make that number 43. Jeremiah 32. Verse 18 to 20. Now let's just make it verse 20. We want to skip around a little. Let's go to the 18th verse and underline some words. The great, the mighty God, the Lord of hosts is his name. That's the 18th verse. Great in counsel and mighty in work, 19th verse, which has set signs and wonders in the land of Egypt, even unto this day. What in the world signs and wonders were in Egypt that God prophesied would declare himself about? That's number 40, what? 43. Now let's just leave that for a moment. Why? Let me ask you, why did Jesus go down to Egypt for refuge? I mean, did he just go to Egypt, as the New Testament records, so God could fulfill a prophecy? Or did the prophecy that he would go down there come from the mouth of God because there was a reason for him going down there? Like the chicken and the egg, you know. I mean, did God sit up there and say, oh, hey, wait a minute, Michael. Let's talk this over. You know, I almost forgot, but I was a little insomniac last night. And so I started rereading out of my computer. I just sort of moved back in time and raced through all history. And you know, we almost forgot. Way back there once, sort of an idle word we dropped, we uttered this prophecy that he'd go down to Egypt. And you know, he's born now, my son that is, and it's not going to be that long before he's crucified and things are given problems there. You know, we can kill two birds with one stone. We can send him down to Egypt and fulfill that prophecy. I don't know why I said it, but because I said it, he's got to go. That makes sense? No, it makes silly, doesn't it? Real silly. Did he go to Egypt to fulfill the prophecy, or was the prophecy made because in the mind of God there's a reason for him going to Egypt? Which do you choose? Reason for him going? Huh? Well, what's the reason? And what's the reason? What in the world did he go down there for? You ever been to Egypt? Except for the pyramid, not that interesting to me. Don't eat any salads there. I want that 500 kings house tonight. Play Rise Again, then I got something to say about Egypt. Let's go to Genesis. Everybody's off the phone. Now, these are the generations of the sons of Noah. He cursed Ham. He blessed Shem. He told Japheth he'd be enlarged, that is, his descendants, and dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan be his servant. 10th chapter of Genesis, one of the most fascinating books or chapters in the whole book. Now, these are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Unto them were sons born after the flood. The sons of Japheth, the one that God said would be enlarged, would be spread out, and dwell in the tents of Shem. The sons of Japheth, Gomer, and Magog, and Madai, and Javan, and Tubal and Meshach and Tyrus, and the sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz and Riphath and Togarmah, and the sons of Javan, Elisha and Tarshish, Kittim and Dodanim. For these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, everyone after his tongue, after their families and their nations. Now, it just frustrates me to death to not define every one of those. But that's not the subject tonight. And the sons of Ham, Cush, ancient Babylon. Now, these Cushites, sons of Ham, let me check something out for just a minute. Got a lot of marks in this old worn-out Bible. Got a little funny squiggly that interests me. See what the squiggly leads to. Can the Ethiopian change his skin? Huh. Well, there must have been something that made the Ethiopian stand out. They were the sons of Cush. Or they were the Cushites. And Mizraim. Underline that word. Mizraim. Now, Cush is Babylon. Mizraim is Egypt. Phut is Libya. And Canaan, we know who Canaan is. So the sons of Ham settled in Babylon and Ethiopia, Egypt, Libya, and Canaan. Now, let's just take off with Mizraim for a moment. We know what happened as we trace those in Babylon down to Nimrod. We know all about them. Can I read to you? All these books on Egypt have always. Nothing has inspired the timeliners like putting down these calendars of the ancient dynasties of Egypt. They're always laying them out from 31 B.C., 3100 B.C. and before, 2680, 3100 B.C. to 2686. They call them the early dynastic period, the Old Kingdom, the first intermediate period, the Middle Kingdom, the second intermediate period, the New Kingdom, and the late period. Now, the late period is 1080 B.C. to the present, or to 30 B.C., to the present era. And most all of these timelines of ancient Egypt would go back before 3100 B.C., pre-dynastic. Then they date 3100 B.C. as the early dynastic period. They find a certain Narmer who may have been, quote, the legendary Menes, or Menes. During this period, Upper and Lower Egypt were united. Now, Upper Egypt is south, which always throws we poor northerners used to saying up north. In Egypt, you say up south. Because Upper Egypt is up the Nile. Egypt is the Nile. They look to it as its life. So upstream is Upper Egypt. Downstream, the Nile Delta is Lower Egypt. During this first early dynasty, they were united. Why did Jesus go down to Egypt? Why did Abram go there? Why does hang up on Egypt? Upper and Lower were united under this Narmer, who may have been the legendary Menes. You know what that says? Nobody knows. I don't mean nobody knows what it says. I mean what it says is nobody knows. Now the world famous writer of the book that shook the scientific world, Worlds in Collision, suppressed literally for many years, that blew apart all the evolutionary concepts and their derivatives of time sequences on this earth, because he challenged the most basic premise of science. And that basic premise of science is that all things remain as they are, and everything always went at the same rate of speed. A sun comes up in the morning and goes down at night. Earth revolves on its axes. A moon goes around the Earth, and an Earth goes around the sun, and a galaxy moves through the universe. And all things are proceeding at the same rate. And it took as long for a mountain to, by erosion, become a sedimentary plateau as it does now. Well, in Worlds and Collisions, this is challenged. And the challenge simply is this. Great cataclysms have hit this earth at various times that have thrown the time sequence awry. And things have not always gone on at the same rate. Now, is Atlantis fiction? And who brought the story of Atlantis to Plato? Plato is a respected Greek philosopher. But this Solon from Egypt tells him of this wonderful isle beyond the gates or pillars of Hercules, which is the Straits of Gibraltar, and its destruction, which has given rise to the search for Atlantis. I don't know what we'll talk about next. In fact, I'm being taped on every hill now, so their programmers can figure out what people are interested in, because they haven't got the nerve to try it. They think all you're interested in is sex and violence and idiocy and lying newscasters. Maybe we will wake them up that you're not so dumb out there, and they ought to tackle something with some meat in it once in a while. And then you'll have to get interrupted every 5 minutes with dog meat commercials. So just stay here. I'd rather be ahead of them than following in their train. Atlantis was discovered, and up the Nile have both been on TV in the last week in this area. What is Atlantis? And you've heard of the equivalent of Atlantis in the Pacific, Mu, haven't you? You ever heard of Mu? Cows aren't the only Mu's. This Mu doesn't give milk. It spawns mysteries. Well, I can't go to Mu. We haven't got to Atlantis yet. Why do those eels go all the way to Europe from the Sargasso Sea? I mean, you're figuring out how long it takes to come from the northwest of Europe as you watch that modern fleet of the British come. Well, the eagles have made a wedding march every 5 years that long. After staying men and women apart for 2 years. I mean, talk about a long engagement. They stay apart for 2 years and then get betrothed and swim under the Gulf Stream all the way to the Sargasso Sea. Then they hide in the seaweed and go at it. We We've got to get back to them eels. Well, the fellow who wrote Worlds in Collision blew the time frame apart. Nobody's ever satisfactorily answered his challenge. Before he wrote Worlds in Collision, he was writing and already had most of it done, Ages in Chaos, in which he analyzed the story of the exodus out of Egyptian bondage by the children of Israel from the Egyptian records of happenings on their side and in their literature and in their archaeological records. Again, he proved things have not always been going on the same way. By the way, how about Joshua's long day? Bible says the sun stood still. Critics say that proves the Bible's idiotic, because we know the earth goes around the sun, not the other way around. Well, that proves how idiotic some scientific biblical interpreters are, because science also says not only is the sun moving, the whole galaxy is moving. Now, if I want to, I can say the whole blame thing stopped and stood still. But furthermore, the Bible is simply describing the impressions of the man who writes it. Many of the biblical prophets saw things they didn't understand. They just tried to describe them. And Ezekiel saw cherubims, and he described their likeness to him. He couldn't tell you what they were. He just said they had this likeness as he drew analogies. And to Joshua and his people, it looked to them like the sun stood still. And if they had tried to describe in those days, well, you see, the earth stopped rotating on its axis, it wouldn't even have been understandable. But to the average man, the earth stood still, the sun stood still, made sense. But have you ever stopped to realize what would happen to this old earth if for a 23.5-hour period in Palestine, you looked up and the sun on a sundial was in the same place for 23.5 hours. You know what would happen to tides? And to the various elements of this earth? And do you know what some timeline? Hey, have you ever seen what? Have you ever read anything or noticed where people have drawn timelines with the approximate date of when Joshua's battle was going on and the scripture says the sun stood still? Have you ever taken the trouble to figure out what that same date by the best records we have on the calendar in North and South America and China and other places was going on that time? Yeah? It's interesting. But the point he makes is, particularly in ages and chaos, things have not always gone on at the same rate. So don't let anybody tell you they got it all figured out. And carbon half-life dating takes a certain kind of substance also. And since it's carbon, who's to say it always went at the same rate? These things are not sure. They have an assumption. And that fundamental assumption is the faith of science. Now, the Christian says, God declares, I am God and I change not. The scientist says, one thing doesn't change. Change has always gone on the same way at the same rate. That just is hard to prove. In fact, it's harder to prove than God existing. The Christian starts with God as the benchmark. The scientist starts with a fallacious assumption. Some scientists, I should say, those who don't believe in God, and some who do, that things have always gone on at the same rate. No, they haven't. So I can tell you, when we move into historic time, when you move into historic time, if you are 50 to 100 years within the date, when you go back beyond 1000 B.C., you're hitting pretty good. When you go beyond 2000, 2400 really stretches it, B.C., you're guessing. You're guessing. Somebody corrected an estimate of something a few weeks ago, and they lopped off 50 million years. I mean, error, 50 million. 50 million years. Well, now, what happened by best indications around 2300, 2400 B.C.? The flood. Now, any date before the flood, hit or miss, because things didn't always go on the same way. You know, have you ever asked yourself, do you believe the Bible? You know, I'm going to get to this in a minute. You see, I'm going to get to this in a minute. Do you believe the Bible? Well, doesn't the Bible indicate it had never rained on the earth? I mean, put yourself in Noah's place. Build a boat, what for? It's going to rain. What's that? He never heard of it. He had never seen it. Now, just imagine for a moment an earth that doesn't have rain. Now, I'm not asking you to imagine it this winter and say, my Lord, wouldn't that be wonderful? I'm not asking you emotionally to imagine an earth that doesn't have rain. I'm saying intellectually. How can it be the earth we know? Huh? Wake up! Sun condenses water, forms clouds, which when they raise in the winds that blow them to a certain level, they cease to be clouds and begin to drip. And we have water that runs to the sea, which condenses and floats out as clouds and comes down. As long as there's a sun in the sky and water to be affected, there will be clouds. And as long as clouds raise, there will be condensation. Well, then it must not have been the same kind of world, huh? Now, Job talks about a firmament. You know what a firmament is? How did we have an earth that never rained? We don't just read the Bible. I'm going to ask yourself some questions. God's not going to have a heart attack because you thought up a question he can't answer. How do we have an earth that didn't rain? I mean, there's no snow either. Well, it's due every morning. It doesn't rain. The atmosphere had to be different, didn't it? Very different. Now, we don't know what Job's talking about when he talked about a firmament. What if there was a different kind of atmosphere? What happened when the flood came? Let me see. What happened when the flood came? I'm not done yet. Let's go back behind Genesis 10. I forgot what it said. Let's see what it says. What did it say? Where did the flood come? Where in the world? What chapter is that? That's right. Chapter 8. It came to pass God remembered Noah, and God made a wind to pass over the earth, and the waters assuaged. What in the world's that? Any of you ever been assuaged lately? That's another dangler. We'll leave that one for a minute. The fountains also of the deep and the windows of heaven were stopped. Windows of heaven stopped, and the fountains of the deep stopped. So water came in two places, from the fountains of the deep and from the windows of heaven, whatever they are. Noah was 600 years old when the flood of waters was upon the earth. The 11th verse of the 7th chapter, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the 2nd month, the 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened. That word windows is alternately translated floodgates. And the rain upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. Noah had never seen a rainbow. Now, God didn't just get a brush out and paint the heaven. The rainbow was the result of atmospheric conditions that for all the generations of mankind from Adam on, apparently, those atmospheric conditions never existed that would produce a rainbow. No rain, no atmosphere that would produce rain, no atmosphere in which a rainbow could be seen. Does that puzzle you? Huh? Now what if there was some kind of atmospheric envelope on this earth that made the whole earth different than it is now, and the whole earth a perfect climate paradise? I don't know how it could be done. I only know what it wasn't. It wasn't like it is now. What it was, I don't know. I can give you some hints, and I will, out of Job and some other places. It was not like it is now. What was it? I don't know. But don't you think the Creator could have figured out some way to create a firmament that made this a perfectly air-conditioned, semi-tropical paradise from pole to pole? You say, I don't know how that could be done. Dummy, it can't be the way it is now. But it weren't the way it is now. Because if it were, there'd have been rain and rainbows. The Bible leaves you no choice. That's why any historic dating of any kind, including that 3,200-year-old blonde woman, or that blonde woman found in China 3,200 years ago, if this Orange County Register is right, and poor old Leakey's African heritage, when you go past 2000 to 2400 B.C., any man's guess counts. So what about tree rings? They'd have grown at a different rate if they were here. If they were here. And the writer of Ages and Chaos and Worlds and Collision proves from 2400 B.C. until now, You can't assume things have always gone on the same. There have been some cataclysmic upheavals since then that upset the date plan. You say, what's this got to do with Egypt? Any man's guess is as good as any other man's guess when you go past 2400 B.C., pre-flood. And everything after the flood is still subject to change if things have not always gone on as they were. Therefore, where do these concepts of dynasties in Egypt come from? Manetho wrote the first dynasties, as Herodotus was to the Egyptians, to the Greeks. Manetho was to the Egyptians, as Josephus was to the Jews. Yet, some of these ancient writers that have maybe 8, 15, or 20 manuscripts extant are given more credence than the Bible that has 4,000 to 5,000 more manuscripts than they have, which proves how obtuse mankind has become, how the prince of the power of the air rules the minds of those not controlled by the Holy Spirit, and how much easier it is to doubt than to fade, and why it's so hard to break you loose from the drag of a non-fading society. Now let's talk about Egypt. Here's a little note about a famous chronologist of Egypt. It's important because I've been talking about shepherd kings, and I told you about three sphinxes, and I left you dangling. Now we're going to talk about the pyramid. We've got to set a frame of reference. Errol Dr. Hale, doesn't matter who you know, that you know him too well because he's wrong, has attempted to substitute the longer chronology of the Septuagint for the Hebrew chronology. Now, what is a Septuagint? A Grecian translation of the Old Testament done in Alexandria, Egypt, by 70 Jewish scholars. And it was in the vogue in Christ's day. The Septuagint has a longer chronology in its Old Testament genealogies than the Hebrew. Why? Because they add 100 years to the age of every patriarch. Exactly 100 years. Now, why would they do that? Dr. Hales has attempted to substitute the longer chronology of the Septuagint for the Hebrew chronology. Now, you understand the difference? Hebrew chronology is the base from which we get our Old Testament. The Septuagint version of the Bible has a longer chronology because it adds 100 years exactly to each of the patriarchs' life. Kind of interesting that it's exactly 100, isn't it? This implies that the Hebrew church, as a body, was not faithful to the trust committed to it in respect to the keeping of the Scriptures, which seems distinctly opposed to the testimony of our Lord in reference to these Scriptures, and that of Paul, both John 5 and 10 and Romans 3, where there's not a hint of unfaithfulness. We can't find any reason for the Jews in Palestine who kept the record of the Old Testament Scriptures to shorten the chronology, but we can find earthly reasons why those Alexandrian scholars in Egypt might want to extend it. That's all he says here. We can find a reason that might induce the translators of the Septuagint in Alexandria to lengthen out the period of the ancient history of the world. We can find no reason to induce the Jews in Palestine to support it or to shorten it. What is the reason? They were running head-on into dynastic datings in Egypt that have no foundation, so they were trying to accommodate. Bunsen, another scholar, casts overboard all scriptural chronology. He says the Hebrew and the Septuagint, all of it, goes out the tube. He sets up the unsupported dynasties of Manetho, the historian that I read you the other night, who comments on the shepherd kings. But Manetho sets up dynasties We can go to the Babylonian records, and they got all the kings before Gilgamesh, story of the deluge. They got all the dynasties. Well, Manetho, the ancient Egyptian chronologist, he set up dynasties, totally unsupported, and science has been trying to follow them ever since. Genesis 10 or the Bible, well, that couldn't be accurate because it's Bible. We're slowly finding the Bible straight. These others sort of augment. It is worthy of notice that Herodotus, the Greek historian, vouches for the fact that at one time there were no fewer than 12 contemporaneous kings in Egypt. 12. Manetho, as observed by Professor Wilkinson, has made no allusion to this, but has made his Thinite, Memphite, and Diospolitan dynasties of kings and the long etc. of other dynasties all successive. So here you have the ancient Greek historian saying here's 12 kings living in Egypt at the same time, and along comes Manetho, and he inverts them and puts them in successive order. Now, who are you going to believe? If you want to make Egypt more ancient than it is, you believe that. The period over which the dynasties of Manetho extend, beginning with Menes, legendary, this other book says, the first king of these dynasties, seen as legendary by the historians, as the Tuatha de Danann are seen as legendary in you know what he says? In Ireland. The period over which the dynasties of Manetho extend, beginning with Menes, the first king of these dynasties, which in itself is long extended, surpassing all rational belief. That's where Manetho begins. Maybe the only thing he's right on, but the time zone is extended beyond rational belief. Bunsen, not content with this extension, one of the experts of time dating of the dynasties, expresses his very confident persuasion that there had been long lines of powerful monarchs in Upper and Lower Egypt during a period from 2,000 to 4,000 years before the reign of Menes. Where do you get that idea? Straight out of nowhere. The back of his head. No proof of that. So what are you doing this for? I used to like to mock historians for being dumber than what they mock the Bible for. The tendency to fill gaps in. In coming to such conclusion, here's where he gets the idea. He goes on the supposition that the name Mizraim, remember we just read it here in the Bible? It's a son of Ham. The name Mizraim, which is the scriptural name of the land of Egypt. Now why is it called that? And is evidently derived from the name of the son of Ham, grandson of Noah, according to Bunsen, is not, after all, the name of a person, but the name of the United Kingdom formed under Menes out of the two, Mizr. He concludes that there was Upper and Lower Egypt, which, using English letters, he says is Mizr, the upper, and Mizr, the lower. And Mizraim, to him, is bringing them together under Menes. Now, you don't have to be an etymologist. You don't have to be a philologist. You don't have to be a cryptologist. You just have to be an ordinary person with common sense to form a judgment which of the two stories I'm going to tell you sound more believable. A guy who conjures up 2,000 to 5,000 years of dynasties that he says existed before Menes, that most books say is legendary because they don't want to try to figure out who he is because that forces them to go to the Bible. and having conjured up 2,000 to 5,000 years of fantasy dynasties. He then says, they all existed, and that which makes Menes different and ties the name Mizraim is, he took the two Mizrs and put them together. Upper and Lower Egypt, which had previously existed as separate kingdoms, the name Mizraim, according to him, being a plural word, Mizraim. You've heard it said you can do anything with numbers. Let me tell you, you ain't seen anything till you see what people can do with etymology, with words. Mizraim being plural, then the kingdom of Mizraim is wrongly stated by the Bible, Mizraim, and was in fact the two Mizrs put together by Menes, who is the legendary, hinted at, first founder of Egypt. But since there were 2,000 to 5,000 years of dynasties conjured up who existed before, the only reason it can be called Mizraim is because the two Mizrs were pluralized into Mizraim under Menes, whoever in the heck he is, and therefore the Bible's just nuts. Isn't that marvelous reasoning? This derivation of the name Mizraim, or Mizraim as a plural word, infallibly leaves the impression that Mizraim, the son of Ham, must be only a mythical person. The Bible's just myth. You convinced? Neither am I. Because there's no real reason for thinking that Mizraim is a plural word. Not an ounce of basis for it other than this guy's imagination. No reason to think that it became the name of the land of Ham for any reason other than because the land was also the land of Ham's son. Mizraim, as it stands in the Hebrew of Genesis, without the points. Now, the Hebrew scholars, they know these little points put on the words. Same word, with or without the points, changes its meaning. Mizraim, as it stands in the Hebrew of Genesis 10, without the points, is Mizraim. And this, I can tell you, is true. Mizraim. Now, what is Mizraim? Mizraim breaks down into two words. Put over on that. Mizraim. Mizraim signifies the encloser or embanker of the sea. The word being derived from im, which means same as yam, the sea, or same as not, you know, we're pronouncing yam as we write it down, but it's yam. We've anglicized the Y into yam. But how many times do we pronounce Y, E? So put a Y in front of it, yam. And you can see it isn't long with somebody saying yam, yam. Yum, yum, yum becomes yum. Sometimes becomes yum, yum. M or yum means the sea. And tzer equals in banker or in clothes. And as the custom was, the formative prefix, the formative M is prefixed in front of the deser. So you have in deser, move your camera and let me move my chair or something. There I can get it. You had it fine once I got out of the way. Eom, the sea, and tzer with the prefix im, which was necessary in their construction. So you have mtzer, mitzer, im, which simply means to enclose the sea. You have to be a genius to figure that out. There is absolutely no basis for mizer, im. And Missouri is but in banker. Well, what in the world do you bank? Missouri M in banker of the sea. Encloser and banker of the sea. Now, it is common practice to see people in heathen areas take on the name of their deeds. Now, what would need to be enclosed in ancient Egypt? Just leave that etymology there for a moment. The Bible is being contested by Bunsen and others as saying Mizraim was not the name of a person at all, but rather the name of the United Egypt. And maybe this legendary Menes ruled over it. The Bible's on trial now. And his basis is a figmented imagination of non-existent dynasties followed by a linking together of words without justification. The word means embanker of the sea. Now, it makes no sense to apply that to Egypt unless there was a sea to be embanked. Correct? If the accounts of ancient history are correct, that's exactly what was there. The first man who formed a settlement there must have come to an area where there was a sea or a swamp that needed to be embanked. Right? Diodorus Siculus tells us, ancient historian, of the order of Herodotus, whom you've heard me reference many times, of the order of Plutarch, of the order of Tacitus. Diodorus Siculus tells us that in primitive times, that which when he wrote Egypt, or what was in primitive times the place of Egypt, was said to have been not a country, this is a direct quote, but one universal sea. That's from Diodorus, 3rd chapter, page 106. Plutarch, another ancient historian, says, from in CD, volume 2, page 367, Egypt, I quote, was sea. Herodotus says he accepts the province of Thebes from his statement. Now, what's Thebes? Upriver, Upper Egypt. He accepts the province of Thebes from his statement, but when it is seen that the province of Thebes did not belong to Mizraim or Egypt proper, which says the author of the article Mizraim in Biblical Encyclopedia, and Mizraim only properly denotes Lower Egypt, then Herodotus is entirely to agree with Diodorus and Plutarch. His statement is, this is Herodotus, the Greek ancient historian, that in the reign of the first king, quote, the whole of Egypt, except the province of Thebes, was an extended marsh. No part of that which is now situate beyond the lake Moeris was to be seen, the distance between which lake and the sea is a journey of 7 days. Thus, according to Herodotus, all of Mizraim or Lower Egypt was underwater. This state of the country arose from unrestrained overflowing of the Nile. The archaeologist Wilkinson has found the evidence and says the Nile formerly in its lowland delta washed the foot of the sandy mountains of the Libyan chain. It was all one vast delta sea. Before Egypt could be fit for a suitable place for human abode, the sea must be driven back. If Ham or Ham's son then led a colony into Lower Egypt and settled it there, this very work he must have done, drive the sea back. What more natural than that a name should be given him in memory of his great achievement? What is that achievement? Mizraim, embanker of the sea. Tzer, to enclose. Iam, in the sea, with the prefix in Mizraim. Mizraim. And his name then is applied in later years to all the land that he freed. Names always tend to abbreviation in the mouths of people, and therefore the land of Mizr is nothing more or less than the land of the embanker. Viewing the matter in this light, what a meaning there is to the divine language of Ezekiel 29:3. Nobody goes to the Bible, see? What does Ezekiel 29:3 say? Judgments are denounced against the king of Egypt, who represents Mizraim. The embanker of the sea, he's referred to, the embanker of his sea, the sea for his pride. Behold, I'm against thee, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, the great dragon that lieth in the midst of his rivers, which says, my river is mine own, I have made it for myself. He turned the sea into a controllable river that provides the riches of Egypt. When we turn to what is recorded of the doings of Menes, the so-called legendary king, who by Herodotus, Manetho, and Diodorus alike is made the first historical king of Egypt, though Bunsen imagined thousands others, compare what's said of him with this simple explanation of the meaning of the name Mizraim. How does the one cast light on the other? Thus does Wilkinson, the great archaeologist and historian, describe the great work which entailed fame of Menes, who, says he, is allowed by universal consent to have been the first sovereign of the country. The archaeologist Wilkinson, who described the Nile washing to the foot of the Libyan mountain chain, says, quote, having diverted the course of the Nile, this is what Menes is said to have done, having diverted the course of the Nile, which formerly washed the foot of the sandy mountains of the Libyan chain, he obliged it to run in the center of the valley, nearly at an equal distance between the two parallel ridges of mountains, which border it on the east and west, and built the city of Memphis in the bed of the ancient channel. This change was effected by constructing a dike about 100 stadia above the site of the projected city. Archaeology has unraveled all this now. This is the archaeologist talking, not ancient historians like Herodotus and Diodorus. This change was effected by constructing a dike about 100 stadia above the site of the projected city. Now, this timeline that goes to the mythical, legendary Menes puts his reign at about 3100 B.C., when the history of Egypt really begins. Everything else is pre-dynastic. Now, Bunsen, as I've said, who had belittled the Bible, has 2,000 to 5,000 years of dynasties that don't exist back here in the pre-dynastic period. Most people begin the dynasties with the legendary Mines, who might be a king of another name. 3100 B.C., they give him the date. But Wilkinson makes it clear that under Menes, the first king, the river was embanked, and the change was effected by constructing a dike about 100 stadia above the site of the projected city of Memphis, whose lofty mounds and strong embankments turned the water to the eastward and effectually confined the river to its new bed. The dike was carefully kept in repair by succeeding kings, and even as late as the Persian invasion, a guard was always maintained there to overlook the necessary repairs and to watch over the state of the embankments. That's Wilkinson's famous work on the Egyptians, Volume 1, page 89. Now, to see that Menes, the first of the acknowledged historical kings of Egypt, by the archaeologist and historian Wilkinson, is credited with the very achievement with the name Mitzrayim signifies as the source of the name of the son of Ham, who was the embanker of the sea. Why not, then, since we've seen names so change depending upon whether you're looking at it from the biblical view or from another language view, who can resist the conclusion that Menes, whom history says did the very thing that the name Mizraim defines, are none other than the one and the same purpose, a person, and Menes and Mizraim are nothing more than two different names for the same person, one given historically by the Egyptian sources and Wilkinson, the other given in the Bible to describe the name of the man who was the embanker of the sea. Now, if that be true, then Menes was the first king, and we have no real history of known dynasties prior to the flood. You understand where I'm headed? We have no dynasties of people successive in nature and no continuous history in Egypt prior to the flood if Menes and Mizraim were one and the same, and if Menes and Mizraim were the first rulers of Egypt. Of the Egyptian dynasties, there is a sharp break. The flood wiped out predecessors, and the son of Ham, settling in Egypt, started the historical dynasties. You understand where I'm going? And if the timeline is correct, then Cheops, somewhere around 2686 B.C., by the timeline. The timeline here says Menes was about 3100 B.C. And if things have always gone on as they are now going on, that means he was before the flood. So if these timelines are right, Menes couldn't be Mizraim, and Mizraim was not the embanker, but Menes was, and his banks were washed away by the flood because he did it for the flood. You with me? But if time has not always been, even since the flood, as ages and chaos and worlds and collision argues, then the dates are wrong. And instead of Menes being 3100 B.C., he was somewhere after 2400 B.C., after the flood. Still with me? And Cheops is way down the trail. Now, Cheops is about 400 to 500 years after Mises. And it is Cheops that is normally credited with building the first pyramid or being the ruler when it was built. That's why it's called the Pyramid of Cheops. And you'll find many references to the Pyramid of Cheops. But there is no proof anywhere in history that Cheops built it. Neither is there proof that the Cheops referred to was the king of Egypt when it was built. Now, why did they get the idea of Cheops? Because they find in two places a name written. A place near the, quote, legendary site of Mount Sinai, which is not, by the way, the same as the one that we now look at on the maps. There is a smelting place and a stonemason place that has the same inscription as the inscription of Cheops on the pyramid, which means that some of what's in the pyramid came from a place over near Sinai, and they find the name Cheops. Now, if this Cheops was 500 years after Menes, and Menes was Mizraim, the son of Ham, then the pyramid was built after the embanker drove the water back and embanked the sea, which the son of Ham did in Egypt, and Cheops, as a successor to the kingdoms after Ham's son, if he built the pyramid, it's a Johnny come lately on the scene. I rules any count, doesn't it? But the Egyptian Book of the Dead calls it Enoch's pillar. And other methods of dating put the date of its construction about 2600 BC, which puts it before the flood. So maybe this Cheops isn't the guy who did it. And maybe there was somebody in Egypt before the flood that's not in these dynastic patterns. Have I got you confused? That was, have I got the historians confused? That was my purpose. You know, they keep cramming down the throat of everybody theories for facts. Their theories have not survived half what the Bible survived. And it's still going strong. There are some people that believe if you read something in the newspaper, God uttered it and sent Michael to hold the newsman's hand while he wrote. And there are people who believe if you read it in a history book, it's God's truth. Horse fit. Or better yet, jackass spit. Because that's what it really initiates as. Some jackass spitting from his pompous conclusions. I have one goal tonight. One goal, to cast a question mark on the know-it-all dynastic datings in Egypt. They are not that solidly based in truth. They start with Manetho, who gives successive generations of dynasties, when Herodotus, who has just as much, in fact, is credited with a more accurate ability to tell history, says there's 12 of them horizontally at the same time. I want a question mark on everybody out there who immediately runs to every library and checks the books and says, any date before the flood is any man's guess. And any dating of the flood and anything since the flood is based upon an assumption that nothing has changed in the time factor of the way things happen on this earth since the flood. Got that premise? That means no major cataclysm that will either speed up or slow down or change the rate of change has occurred since the flood. Now, is there anybody who wants to try to say they can prove that? Anything before the flood is up for grabs because it was a different kind of world. You got that point? Anything after the flood is questionable in its dates on up until known recorded history as we have it. Anything is questionable because it's based upon an assumption that all change has proceeded in every dimension at the same rate of speed that we now see it happening. And all it has done to push it back prehistory is to take time factors of the modern scene and say, since it's always been the same, we will project this backwards. If we can figure out how long it takes a tree ring to form, we can count the rings and go back. Well, maybe tree rings didn't always form at the same rate. Got that? Now, we're trying to figure out, what's the question asked a long time ago? Who built this thing? Enoch? Methuselah? No ordinary man built it. Either Ham did it with the devil's help, or Enoch or Methuselah did it with God's help, or Noah did it with God's help. But I'm betting on Noah not driving the sea back, but building boats to float on it. That's my bet on Noah. I mean to tell you, if I'd gone through what Noah went through, with a rain I never heard of, and I learned how to build a boat, I'd never stop building boats till I died, rainbow or no rainbow. I'd believe like Cromwell, trust in God, keep your powder dry, and build your boats. That make sense? I mean, a guy get drunk after the rain, sure gonna lose faith once in a while, keep a boat on in the backyard. Put flesh and blood on these characters. Now, my choices presently are, I don't know who Cheops is. I mean, that's an Egyptian name for him. I don't know who Cheops is. If he's the guy who built it, just find his name on it. I believe somebody in touch with God or the devil with a little supernatural and superhuman help got it done. You say, you mean you're going to go that far? Sure, I believe God spoke and the whole world's formed. I want to figure out how to move those blame rocks. I mean, I can find a few places in the Bible, particularly in the book of Revelations, where angels move rocks awful fast. Did Enoch build it? Or was he the architect? Are you two quick yes people? Did he build it? Or did he design the plans? And did Methuselah give the plans to Noah along with the book of Enoch? And was it built after the flood by Noah or Shem, who maybe also built Salem and might have been Melchizedek? Or did Ham build it? Now, if Enoch or Methuselah, it was built before the flood. Well, I'm convinced it. Some people say nothing could survive that flood. Prove it. I mean, it was covered in polished limestone that a barnacle couldn't get a grip on. You say, how come no capstone? Well, we'll get to that. Don't tell me it couldn't survive the flood. Were you there? How do you know?
Huh?
Misery hadn't come and banked the sea. And frankly, well, I ask you a simple question. Simple question. With only 8 people in the world, plus their kids, maybe we got 25 or 30, who in the heck wants to go to Egypt? Let the blame thing stay underwater. I've had all the water I want. Find a hill. Now, does that make sense or not? I mean, if you're overcrowded in this world and there ain't no land left for anybody, then build a dike. But who in the heck wants to sandbag a river when there's a whole empty world? Put some flesh and blood in the Bible. Would you? You ever sandbagged a river? That'll make a mountain climber out of you quick. Only people in Fort Wayne, Indiana can't find a mountain. I have to be concerned about that. Where's the nearest swamp? I mean, if you had the whole world to live in, would you make it your life's work to go drain the Everglades? Now answer my question, would you? Well, I mean, these people lived 300 or 400 years. They gotta be at least as smart as a 10-year-old. Why drain the swamp when you got a whole world? Unless there's something there that makes it worth draining for. What if there's a pyramid? Huh? Of great spiritual significance. Huh? I mean, I'd go there and drain swamps in a hurry. I mean, draining swamps not half as bad as fighting back dung. Why don't you go inside and find its mystery? The water seeped into all of it. It's going to be centuries before it evaporates away under the new system of things. I mean, draining the swamps, not bad. There ain't going to be a deep sea diver in a pyramid yet. But just think about it a minute. What in the world would make anybody go and drain that area? Isn't that puzzled you, Stan? Huh? Yeah. I mean, why drain the blame place? I know Daddy Noah, he's probably up there at Kenosis on Crete with his ships and his marble palaces. Now that interests me. You know what I think the answer is? You think you're going to get it tonight? Well, you've talked to me. I've stayed later in this before. Why don't you talk to me? What do you think? Would you drain the Everglades if you had the whole world to live in? Then why did this guy go drain that swamp? Answer me. Get on the phone.